Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Today is a day where we celebrate quite a series of historical anniversaries. On the one hand, you have in 1924, the day when Vladimir Lenin was placed in a mausoleum in the Red Square. He was preserved, his body was preserved and embalmed as a kind of public relic for the new faith of the Soviet experiment, and Lenin became its first saint, if you will. There's also the anniversary of the cessation of the Leningrad massacre, and over 2 million Russians died. And we have enough of a concern in those areas. But today is also the anniversary, 1945, of when Soviet troops entered Auschwitz and Birkenau. And that's why today, in a lot of ways, it's remembered as Holocaust Memorial Day. I want to focus on that issue. I want to talk about Holocaust denial as an abuse of history. And my reason why is because I've been seeing more and more vitriol in the public sphere, and a rising tide of anti-Semitism, so to the point where some rather absurd talking points amongst Catholics seem to arise. I've even heard statements to the effect of, I'd rather say Islamo-Christian than Judeo-Christian, because any and all affiliation with the Jewish people is seen to be completely abhorrent. Now, thankfully, Holy Mother Church has weighed in on what a virtuous, holy, and charitable relationship with the Jewish people should look like. Ever since 1965, with Nostra Aetate onwards. But today, however, I want to talk about the historical reality of the Holocaust, the rise of Holocaust denialism, and this rewriting of history, and why it's bad, why we as Catholics have a moral obligation to honor the truth and to speak it out unabashedly for the sake of, A, this race of people who were nearly wiped out, but secondly, to honor the fact that these are people who possess the dignity of God in terms of being children of the Abrahamic covenant in blood and in covenant. We go on from there to talk with Jennifer Roback Morse about surrogacy gone wild. And then finally, we speak with my friend Dr. Dan Guernsey, Catholic Schools Week, and the need for truth-based education. Let's go to the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, January 27th. It's the Feast of St. Angela Merici. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. A meeting is expected to be held between President Trump's border czar Tom Homan and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. This comes as tensions in Minnesota continue to run high following the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Alex Preddy by a federal immigrant agent. Homan is taking over as Trump's point person in Minnesota as top Border Patrol official Greg Bovino is returning to his old position in California. Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem getting a vote of confidence from President Trump. When asked earlier today, he said he has no plans to replace her. Senate Democrats are looking to speed up passage of 5 government funding bills in hopes of avoiding a partial government shutdown at the end of the week. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer made the announcement Monday. However, the Democrats' plan will exclude funding for the Department of Homeland Security. If a deal can't be reached by Friday, it would result in a partial government shutdown. Today is the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day set aside each year to remember the millions killed by the Nazi Third Reich during World War II. 86-year-old Peter Lantos, who as a child was a prisoner at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, remembers being liberated.
It was Americans, because we were put on a train before the British arrived in Belsen, and our life has changed completely. We became free. We could eat, had food.
Some 12 million people were systematically murdered by the regime between 1933 and 1945, including 6 million Jews. Today is also the anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. In 1945, on January 27th, Soviet troops entered Auschwitz and Birkenau. They opened the gates of what had become the most industrialized killing center in human history. The only event that overshadows the mechanistic brutality of Auschwitz and Birkenau is modern abortion today. But what the Soviet troops encountered defied language at that point. It stretched the limits of moral comprehension. Corpses were lying around unburied. The survivors themselves resembled walking corpses. The warehouses held hair, shoes, suitcases, eyeglasses, prosthetic limbs. All of these were carefully cataloged remnants of lives that were reduced to inventory and statistics. This date now stands as the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's an annual summons to the world of memory, of conscience, of vigilance. The problem is, memory, as history repeatedly shows, especially in our social media digital era, is fragile. In the decades since the liberation of Auschwitz, the horror has faced a new enemy. It's not tanks or barbed wire anymore. This enemy operates through insinuation, through distortion, through selective doubt, cynical manipulation, Holocaust denial, and its softer, more socially palatable cousin, Holocaust distortion. They've moved from the fringes of extremist subcultures into the broader public discourse. The phenomenon carries consequences that reach far beyond Jewish history. In fact, the only way they can function is to corrode the foundations of truth itself. The Holocaust possesses the grim distinction of being the most thoroughly documented genocide in history. Nazi bureaucrats recorded the deportations, the transports, the labor assignments, the executions, and extermination protocols. In fact, they were almost obsessively precise about it. We also have survivor testimony. We have the confessions of the perpetrators. We have the observations of the bystanders. And we also have photographs of that were taken by the Allied soldiers. The trials have records, the Nuremberg trials have records under oath. So to deny all of that evidence requires a prior commitment to wanting to embrace a lie. It requires an ideological lens that is willing to overlook objective evidence rather than follow it. Deborah Lipstadt wrote a book about denying the historicity of the Holocaust, and she observed, Holocaust denial functions as an assault on historical truth itself because it creates a climate that fosters deconstructionist history at its worst, where no fact, no event, and no aspect of history has any fixed meaning or content. Holocaust denial takes multiple forms. Hardcore denial claims that no systematic plan existed to exterminate Europe's Jews. The gas chambers were inventions but nothing more. The numbers are exaggerated and the documents are forgeries. Softcore denial adopts a more strategic posture. Sure, the genocide occurred, but perhaps 6 million is an inflated figure. Perhaps the gas chambers were for disinfection. Perhaps comparisons dilute the uniqueness of the crime, but all of these moves, what they do is they attempt to appear reasonable, scholarly, detached, but it has the same corrosive end, to weaken the moral reality and clarity, and then, as a result, to blur the moral responsibility to the event, especially by Christians. There's a psychological motive at play here, and it's been consistent ever since Holocaust denialism has started. Deborah Lipstadt identified this dynamic by writing that genocide victims carry a form of moral authority. But if you strip that authority away, history becomes negotiable, at least this event, and the responsibility becomes transferable. So the perpetrators, the collaborators, the ideological heirs, they now gain space to rehabilitate not just their reputations, but also the narratives that brought about that massacre to begin with. And that's why we're seeing that kind of anti-Semitism rear its ugly head again. This kind of de-victimization for people who are valid victims restores a moral grandstanding to those who want to escape real historical judgment. That's why the modern resurgence of denial and distortion, the digital culture has a lot to do with it. Some of you might already know social media commentators who espouse some form of Holocaust distortionism or even denialism. The social media platforms that we know right now, we need to understand this, their algorithms are programmed to reward provocation, outrage, and tribal affirmation. The algorithms privilege engagement and anger over truth and accuracy, because truth and accuracy doesn't gain the shares and the reactions. According to studies cited in recent Holocaust education research, anti-Semitic symbols and Holocaust denial content surged dramatically across online platforms in recent years. Of course, they are cloaking it as historical inquiry or even political critique. They are only, quote-unquote, asking questions about the validity of these things. But the narratives are recruiting the curiosity and hostility of people who want to deny this event. Our political culture has also provided a fertile soil. Public figures in multiple countries have trivialized the Holocaust. They've minimized its significance, or they associated it openly with denialist groups. Legislative efforts in parts of Europe have attempted to sanitize national histories. They criminalize discussion of their local complicity with the Holocaust. Museums and memorial institutions, especially across Europe, have selectively emphasized national suffering and not emphasizing the Jewish victims and their real plight. And each of these gestures appear isolated, but we're really seeing a collective global movement here, a broader retreat from the honesty of this historical event. History itself shows us how this retreat is possible. During the war, Nazi officials employed euphemisms to disguise their mass murder. They used terms like special treatment and, quote-unquote, the final solution. All of this was to conceal what it really was, which is a genocide, an actual genocide, not the kind of euphemistic trite talking points that we hear today. As the defeat of Germany approached, efforts intensified to destroy evidence. Actian 1005 forced Jewish prisoners to exhume and burn corpses, after which those same prisoners were then murdered. Even during the war, this kind of deception shaped the paradigm. The 1944 Red Cross visit to Theresienstadt, it was meticulously staged by Nazi authorities, but they succeeded in masking starvation, disease, deportation behind normalcy. So after the war, what happened? Well, Eastern Europe was still communist, and so official narratives emphasized political resistance, but the Jewish victims became footnotes. In Western Europe and beyond, societies were exhausted by war, so they wanted to forget about the whole thing altogether. And anti-Semitism continued, and that just reinforced the silence. Decades later, the event received some scholarship, survivor testimony, public memorialization. But the centrality of the Shoah in modern history, it was never established. We are less than 100 years from the gas chambers of Auschwitz, and many people already have forgotten the atrocity of the event. Today, that kind of outright denial is resurfacing. And it is dishonest. This matters because an event like the Holocaust, represents a moral fault line in human history. Once a subset of individuals become subhuman in law, extermination follows as an administrative policy. That's exactly what's happening with abortion, euthanasia, and assisted suicide. It's also what happened with slavery. The responsibility of education is urgent. We need to repeat those words, never again. Classrooms are going to be the front line of this event. And we cannot give in to ideological intimidation. I don't care how anyone feels about the state of Israel. We need to acknowledge objective truth about history where it needs to be acknowledged. That's why remembrance of the Holocaust is an act of Catholic moral justice. It honors the dead. It protects the living. It guards truth from manipulation. In that sense, International Holocaust Remembrance Day demands more than a casual observance. We need to be intellectually honest, morally vigilant, and culturally courageous. Our world is increasingly impatient, but the Shoah, the Holocaust, is an unyielding teacher. Let's learn from it. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian prayer series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking, and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. A report that a Chinese billionaire fathered more than 100 U.S. children poses a monumental human rights issue. Jennifer Roback Morse joins us. Jennifer is the founder, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute, which helps the victims of the sexual revolution recover from their experiences and become advocates for positive change. Jennifer, great to speak with you again. I always enjoy reconnecting with you. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Marcus.
Let's talk about this story. Thank you for your piece in the National Catholic Register. Let's talk about this story in case our listeners don't know what has happened.
Well, I found it in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, because usually the Wall Street Journal is all in favor of anything that the market does, you know. But in this case, even the Wall Street Journal is scratching its head because this is a case of not just one. There was one Chinese billionaire that they talked about quite a bit, but there were several who basically used the U.S. surrogacy laws to sire an army of children, basically. So this one guy who's a video game maker, you know, lots and lots of money, kind of a recluse, kind of a little bit nerdy, different kind of guy, probably, you know, there's a vibe that you get. But, you know, he commissioned, he's looking to create 100 high quality sons who can take over his business when he's old. And he's trying to create a dynasty. And the journal went on to report on other similarly wealthy Chinese nationals who wanted to have a bunch of girls and then marry their daughters off to, you know, important world leaders and this kind of thing, you know. And of course, there are problems. The journal was also interested in the fact that these kids could count as American citizens because they'd be, if they used a U.S. surrogate and they're born in the United States, you know, they could count as a U.S. citizen. So there are any number of problems that could be that could arise from this situation. The thing that I really wanted to call attention to and to make a point of is, what about these kids? You know, what in the world are we doing to these children? By what right are we doing such a thing that a man would go and purchase genetic material and then purchase the services of a rental womb, basically, and then arrange to have his children, to have these children assigned to him as the father in a hearing in Los Angeles that he didn't even show up to. You know, he wants parental rights, but he can't even be bothered to show up. What in the world kind of life are these kids going to have? And I think that I'll I think it's absolutely time for people to open their eyes and say, look, the fertility industry is much more than the smiling faces of babies that you see on the brochures of an IVF clinic. There's a lot of very dark business hiding behind those smiling baby pictures. And this is, I don't know if this is as bad as it gets, but it's bad enough, wouldn't you think, Marcus?
Oh, I certainly think so. And the tragic irony of this is, of course, he targets the United States for a number of reasons, economic being chief among them. But the other reason is surrogacy is illegal in China. And the irony of that all.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're buying and selling people over here. I mean, that's really what it amounts to. So the U.S. market is completely unregulated. And my position is, and I think the church's position is, you cannot regulate this enough to make it okay. You know, it's fundamentally wrong to be buying and selling people. And we have to come back to the church's teaching that every person has the right, the natural human right, to come into existence as a result of the loving embrace of their own mother and father who love each other. You know, they love each other, and their love produces you, the child, the new baby. Some of us have that right, and some of us now do not, and categorically do not have that right. And we're acting as if this is no big deal, but in fact, it's a huge deal, and we're just sleepwalking into it. You know,
the further heartbreak of the situation is owing to the way surrogacy contracts are written up. These children, because clearly this man, Zhu Bo, has no desire to raise the children himself. So the birth mothers, the biological mothers, will not raise the children. He will not raise the children. So you've got 100, for want of a better expression, orphans in just out there in U.S. society that he wants to claim as a right to parent.
Yeah. So these children have two mothers, actually. They have a genetic mother who is different from the gestational mother. Okay, so think about, well, already that's a problem, right? You know, even if it wasn't a billionaire who had 100 of them like that, you know, there's already a breakdown in the identity of the mother. The maternal bond doesn't mean the same thing that it should mean and that it means to most people and throughout all of human history. The other thing that came out in the article is just how efficient this little market is. Well, actually, it's a huge market in the sense that the people who, it's not that there are so many people who want these services, but the people who want these services have a lot of money. And so they describe the fact that, you know, a wealthy person in a foreign country can commission a certain number of children. There are agencies that will help them. And they literally use this phrase that one guy had placed an order for 100 babies. Okay, placed an order. Think about that. He placed an order for children. And these agencies are running around recruiting the donors, recruiting egg donors, recruiting the surrogates. They even have the services where they'll pick the baby up for you. They'll transfer all the paperwork around for you. There'll be nannies when you need the nannies. All this type of stuff that they'll do to make it easier for you to have the baby that you want for about $200,000. All this whole concierge package will cost you. So what we've got here, Marcus, is a system where people with money get to do anything they want. And I just can't see how you can redeem a system like that.
You look at the language of the system, the kind of language that came out. I'm really glad you quoted it. They helped fill an order for a Chinese parency. I'm a father of very young children. My bride and I know the struggles of having children, wanting children, and having children. To see this is legitimately, interiorly infuriating.
Yeah. And you know, the infertility industry, as it happens, Marcus, back in the 1980s, when my husband and I wanted to start a family, we found that we couldn't right away. And we had a long struggle with infertility. And the IVF was just starting to be a thing. And I was repulsed by it. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But what I remember from that period of time very clearly, you know, of course, infertility is a miserable experience. And I will not take anything away from somebody's grief over being unable to conceive naturally. I really do understand. But the fact is, the infertility industry preys on the vulnerability of that couple. And we saw many couples go through this process, Marcus, you know, where the every cycle they would get so, you know, elated and then crash, elated and then crash. And it created tension within the married life because, generally speaking, it was the woman who was desperate to have the baby and the father's trying to figure out, the husband's trying to figure out, what am I, I want to make my wife happy, but this is really not a good thing. You know, and so that, and the industry just fed all of that, right? And they preyed upon the person's vulnerability, whereas what we chose to do was to adopt. And with adoption, every step you take, you know, you release the idea that you're going to have a baby. You know, just let go of that. I'm never going to have a baby. I'm at peace with that. So you make peace with that. And then every step you take, you actually do come closer to a baby. You know, I had two long days in the immigration office to get my little boy to come from Romania. You know, all the home studies and doctor's appointments, all that stuff that you have to go through to do an adoption. But as you do it, you actually are coming closer to a baby. Whereas with the big tech, big tech fertility industry, you can go at it, you know, time cycle after cycle and never come closer to the baby. You know what I mean? And yeah. So they're just feeding on that. It's predatory, and it's predatory on the women who are donating their eggs. Sometimes at more risk to themselves than they realize. You know, I'm just going to say it that way, you know, because there are problems with that. Mm-hmm. It's a predatory industry, yeah. And it should be, the whole thing should be stinking shut down. That's my opinion.
I agree, and the sooner we get there, the better. Jennifer, thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. We've been talking about this horrendous case of a Chinese national who, through surrogacy, has fathered more than 100 children in the United States, and the concerns that this raises about the surrogacy industry. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the following nonprofit, Christendom College.
Each summer, hundreds of high school juniors come to Christendom College for the best week ever. A week-long experience of classes in philosophy, literature, history, and theology, daily mass and adoration, activities like canoeing, debating, dancing, and bonfires in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. Students leave with a deeper appreciation for the liberal arts and lasting friendships that stay with them long after the weekend ends. Learn more at thebestweekever.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
What are the three parables Jesus tells about prayer in St. Luke's Gospel? The first is what the Catechism calls the importunate friend. This is the friend who wakes a pal at midnight in order to borrow three loaves of bread to feed a visitor. The second parable the Catechism labels the importunate widow, who persistently pleads for her rights from a reluctant judge till the wearied judge rules in her favor. This parable illustrates the need to pray always and with the patience of faith. Jesus closes this parable with the poignant question, "When the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith on the earth?" The third parable centers on the Pharisee and the tax collector, commending the tax collector for his humility because he asked God to be merciful to me, a sinner, a prayer which the church adopts as its own. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Steve and Janet Ray here, inviting you to join us in Portugal, Spain, and France as we follow the three children of Fatima and Saint Bernadette of Lourdes and encounter lots of surprises along the way. These moving apparition sights never fail to inspire awe, healing, and a love for Our Lady, exquisite countryside, and our Spanish chaplain, Father Alfonso Aguilar.
To learn more about your Ave Maria Radio trip, find the Ave Maria Radio Travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. This week, students are celebrating Catholic Schools Week in an era where our society has forgotten the reality of objective truth. The need for truth-based education has never been greater. Joining me to talk about this is Dr. Dan Guernsey, Senior Fellow at the Cardinal Newman Society, Director of Ave Maria University's Masters in Education in Catholic Educational Leadership Program. Dan, great to speak with you. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
Thank you, Marcus. I appreciate you having me back on. Yes, and I've added a new feather into my cap. I'm actually running a group called NAPSIS, the National Association of Private and Independent Catholic Schools. So
An
accrediting agency that accredits about 50 Catholic, small independent Catholic schools around the country. And, you know, we're doing all we can to support Catholic education because, as you mentioned, the need is great and the battle for truth has never been more fierce. It's always been a battle, but the storms are against us, but we're raging against them.
Dan, that is outstanding. I did not know this, and I'm very glad that you're sharing this with us. And before we get into the conversation proper, I wonder if you could share a little bit more about this new enterprise and the scope of it. Are you doing just institutional schools, homeschool co-op programs? Like, what's the scope of it?
As always, you're right over the target. So NAPSIS has been around for 30 years, accrediting small, independent, lay-run schools. And just recently, the Cardinal Newman Society has taken over NAPSIS and made it a subsidiary of the Cardinal Newman Society. So now we're going to take Cardinal Newman's reputation for brand excellence in Catholic education and translate that down, certainly into the historic market of independent Catholic schools, but then raise that out of that market back to diocesan schools, parish schools, and also moving into the new trends that are coming up with faithful online Catholic schoolings. NAPSIS accredits Colby Homeschool, for those of you who are familiar with that. And also looking into accrediting micro schools. So the idea is that we are nimble, aggressive, creative, and doing everything possible to battle big ed in the fight for truth in our children's souls.
I am very, very grateful for this effort. And I'm saying this on the air, whatever we can do to support this effort, we gladly will, because this, like you mentioned, this is a needed effort. And so that's a great segue, because like you mentioned, we take for granted the fact that education is something that parents have a moral obligation to do when you have a child. But what we can't take for granted is that education can spell the eternal salvation of their soul or its opposite. Can we springboard from there to the conversation of truth-based education?
Sure, right. And the church is very clear on that. We have a responsibility, not just we have a natural responsibility to provide education to our children, but we have a supernatural responsibility to provide for a Catholic education of our children. So all parents are required to ensure that their children have a deep knowledge of the faith, however that's being delivered to them. The Catholic school is a privileged way to make that happen. It's not the only way. And as we said, parents are being creative because not everybody can find a faithful Catholic school or afford one. So parents are creatively developing micro schools and doing homeschooling and all sorts of things to make that happen. But no effort should be spared to not only protect our own children, but because that's the first thing is to get them to heaven. But the second call is that we're supposed to evangelize. Our children are supposed to be a leaven to the world. And whether the world wants to receive that leaven or not is not our business. It's just we, our business is to make them seekers and lovers of the truth and seekers and lovers of God.
And that, therefore, leads us to the heart of the work of education, which is, like you mentioned, the formation of the soul for the pursuit of truth, ultimately, because truth finds its fullest expression in God.
Yes, and it's happening both at the individual level and at the corporate level. So this is, again, part of the Catholic genius, right? We are part of three societies. We're part of the family, we're part of the church, and we're part of general society. And all of those societies are supposed to support each other and move the whole world into a celebration of Christ as the King of all hearts and the King of the world. So when these three societies are working together, that's the goal. But the challenge is the societies are not always working together. And so, you know, the parents' first responsibility is to their children. But then again, we also are bringing those children in to be truth tellers and truth presenters to the world, to give the people a chance to hear the gospel and a chance to determine their own eternal destinies. So it really is a great drama to be in Catholic education, wherever it's happening, if we have the eyes to see. And that's what we have to remember, that what's actually coming around us. Are we apprehending reality truthfully? So this idea of truth, right? Thomas tells us, Aquinas, that truth is when the mind is in accord with reality. So what's happening, as you know, as we've talked about in your show, is, you know, the world wants to place truth within ourselves and our desires, but in reality and in God's revelation, truth exists outside of us because it all comes from God and is united in God. And our response is to respond to the truth outside of us, not to create our own truth within us. It's the fundamental battle of humanity, and as a culture, things are not going well.
As you rightly mention, it's this fundamental battle between us, between that which is objectively true, Prima Pars question 16, right? It's the question of what's true, what is truth? And then there's that greater impetus, the human impetus, to want to rebel against that truth and to be the arbiter of our own truth. Can you talk about that struggle a little more and why a lot of modern education is leaning towards this kind of relativistic grasp of the truth?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're leaning into it. It's their very fiber of their being, right? The stakes have gone that high in post-modernity. So again, what we do, I teach a Foundations of Education course here at Ave Maria, and the first work we read in a semester is a book on relativism, because that is the water that our students, both our college students and our grade school students, and even many of our families are swimming in, and they have to really decide, you know, what are you going to drink? What are you going to drink from? The waters of Christ and his truth, or the waters of modernity and relativism? So we really have to see that battle starkly and the consequences of rejecting of objective-based truth. Once you do that, you're stuck. Once you reject objective truth, you're just reduced to chaos and power. And it's such a losing proposition. It's so boring. It's so unfulfilling, that once you explain it to the students, they get it, right? We all long for meaning and story and justice, and the very drama of life is based on objective truth. Without it, it's all, you know, sound and fury, a tale told by an idiot, as Shakespeare would you know, have Hamlet say.
And, yeah, life's brief candle. What an apropos image for education, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
But again, what we've got is when we do Catholic education well, we've got the good news, right? We've got such awesome, you know, you've got truth, beauty, and goodness and wonder, the foundation of education. So many of our faithful liberal arts schools and our faithful Catholic schools are reclaiming this heritage. So as it gets darker, you know, it's been weighed and found wanting. Modernism and relativism, it just doesn't work. It makes for a very shallow, maybe a titillating life in some ways, but I think people are becoming more attuned to the fact that there's not a lot of there. And it's too high cost to pay to make reality based on your desires. It's much more dramatic to have reality call you into something higher. And that's what we're made for. That's the way it is.
And to to springboard off of a statement you just made, which is that this kind of relativistic approach to education, first of all, it's only ever going to be utilitarian. And secondly, that means that its teleology is self-defeating. But like you said, it's been weighed and found wanting. Meanwhile, the Catholic ethos of education... Oh, go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, but it's intoxicating.
Right.
It's intoxicating to... The heart of a teacher is often what one might describe as perhaps a more giving, even liberal heart, right? It's open to just accepting and nurturing. And if you go too far in that direction and try to do that, where the truth, you start sensing that the truth is somehow against nurturing, that's when you have these conflicts happening. So many teachers are naturally bent to a giving, nurturing mode, but without the truth, it goes off the rails very quickly.
My guest is Dr. Dan Guernsey, and his wisdom about Catholic education and frankly, just honest, truth-based education is unassailable. We continue on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com. to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces." If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we? The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I come from the other side of the tracks, see? My uncle used to have slot machines. Put one nickel in and it's emptied. Boom. And I brought him home in a bag, and my mother looked at me. "Where did you get all that money?" I said, "I won them." "You didn't win them. He fixed the machine." I didn't care if he fixed the machine or not, you know?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I've got to vent. Is this so? It's old theory, somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Guernsey, Senior Fellow at the Cardinal Newman Society, Director of Ave Maria University's Master of Education in Catholic Educational Leadership Program. And he's also one of the lead people, you'll have to refresh me on your new position, but of NABCIS, which is an effort of accreditation by the Cardinal Newman Institute, bought over by the Cardinal Newman Institute.
You got it right. Yep. On we go. Yes. All good things.
All wonderful things. So, Dan, like you were mentioning earlier, there's a kind of, you use the word intoxicating, and I can't find a more on-the-nose description for exactly what relativistic education does. It really is very enticing. It draws you in, and then you become part of this herd mentality that believes everything and nothing together at the same time.
Yeah. And again, and it comes into the foundations of modern education, again, coming out of Rousseau and Dewey, right? Rousseau was coming back in the Romantic period saying, you know, the individual is good, the desires are good, society is bad, the church is bad, external constraints are bad. It's got to all come from within and you be you. And that's very much a part of the educational paradigm. And then Dewey sprinkles on the pragmatism on top of that. How do we know if it's good? If it works. If most of the people say this is a good idea, that's what we have. But what both of these things do is take God out of the picture and put man, either the individual and his desires, or man, the society, thinking we all think this is a collective hunch about what's true, in charge. And you do this with our, you know, children generation after generation, and you get the moral chaos and blandness and darkness that we're in. So what Catholic education has to provide, if it's properly done, is, you know, every individual is unique and good and created by God, but also we are created for community, for others. And so accepting that and unpacking that is what Catholic education can do in a much deeper way. But the, you know, Chesterton calls education the passing on of the soul of a society from one generation to the next. And for generations, we've been passing on a materialistic, atheistic, pragmatic, soulless society now for a couple of generations. So the general culture out there is in big trouble, but faithful Catholic education, which has also been handed on from generation to generation, heart to heart, disciple to disciple, is also still chugging along. And so we in the Catholic faith and the Catholic community, right, we are passing on the soul of Catholicism, the soul of revelation that we've received from the Church Fathers and from the community into the modern world. So again, what we have to do in Catholic education is so rich that why would we turn our eyes outside to the world in jealousy and say, what are they up to? It's like, well, they're up to no good. What we've got is something just so much more to give. So I think that's the message I would just share with all of our good Catholic educators, moms and dads, homeschoolers, Catholic schools, is just, you know, rejoice in what we have and don't look to the world, you know, really, you know, not that they're not doing too well out there. So, you know,
they really aren't. And no. In some ways, to be, like you mentioned, Dewey, Rousseau, I might even go to Marx and say that in some ways, modern culture has made even the most well-meaning of Christians accidental Marxists, in that everyone's a materialist, especially when it comes to thinking about education and labor, work. Can you speak to that? Because that seems to be a primary concern for parents.
Yeah. And this can even come filter its way down into our own Catholic schools, into our own you know, homeschooling experience, or working with our own children, where everything becomes about the child's desire. Now I'm going to the extreme there. Right, but the fundamental question to ask in education is our focus on the man, or is it on the child. Now, in liberal arts education, what we call classical education, the focus was always on the man. Here's what we are educating the child to become. We want them to be a virtuous, self-regulating adult with prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. We want them to be a faithful Catholic representative and saint going forward. Or is it, no, we're educating the child. What's the child interested in today? How can I adapt to the child's need today? Now, you don't want to ignore the child. you want to make, you know, try to figure out how to adapt what the man to where the child is at the moment, but you don't want to just leave the child to his or her own devices or his or her own interests. That there's a time to activate freedom, but that typically comes in the older stages. Once one is typically in the late adolescent stage, right? When they're well-formed, thinking, reflective individuals, that's when they go. But when a lot of what we do in education is saying, well, we have to intrigue the child because the child is going to get bored, or the child is going, you know, we have to make this exciting or whatever. And I think we just have to take a deep breath, take a step back and say, we know what we're trying to become. We're trying to become like Christ, who revealed us to ourselves. That's our goal. Let's get our children there, as opposed to just saying, well, we don't really know what's going on. It's a collective hunch and, you know, we'll see. So just to reclaim that kind of existential confidence is something, again, I encourage your listeners, again, as they get fed by the discussions that you have on this program, is, you know, have at it and engage in the conversations. Don't shy back. The truth will, you know, in some ways defend itself. It'll take care of itself, but you have to make sure it's presented and not hidden.
Okay, so one of the things that I've always admired about the Donahue Academy, Ave Maria University, is there's never a paradigm of approaching with the lowest common denominator. And I hope I'm phrasing this rightly. This kind of heresy of low expectations, as if the child is unable to engage in those truths that the child's actually made to engage from a young age. Can you please speak to that?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think works in well-run schools and Catholic schools is we introduce them to very significant and intriguing topics. We present viable explanations for what's going on, and then we say, try it out, test it, right? Test the waters, see what works and what doesn't work. But we're not afraid to present an interpretive framework within which to analyze the thing you're seeing. Now, the kids can reject the interpretive framework. They can say, well, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in truth. Okay, you can do that, but what are the logical consequences of you doing that, and what do you have to give up to make that happen? What cost comes to that world? And then, you know, you explain that, you know, once you leave objective-based truth and you move into relative, you're only left with silence, and you can't say anything. You're dead in the water. It doesn't work. So I think that's the idea of inviting the kids, especially when they get into late middle school and high school, into the great topics that humanity has wrestled with, so that they don't have to think, I'm just getting a summary, I'm just getting an anthology. You get them actually into the great text. Have them read little snippets of Plato. Have them read Plato. You can't give in the whole to a little kid, but you can in college. But they can read the whole of literature in middle school and high school, and really have them unpack the human condition.
And that unpacking of the human condition is something that a child's naturally metaphysical mind is already attempting to do. So it's a work of charity to give them the structures, the infrastructure necessary to do that work.
Yeah. And the confidence when they start reading Shakespeare, it's like, I'm with the big boys. I'm with the big girls. I'm with the adults now. I'm not being treated, you know, like a kid anymore. I'm being introduced into the greatest thoughts. And this is, again, what comes back from, you know, kind of the classical paradigm or liberal arts paradigm, is you give the students the best models with the clearest articulation, and then say, what say you? How do you think about, you know, the nature of relationships, or justice in this case, or jealousy or hatred or whatever it is? What do you think? And then you hold them accountable to articulate that. But if you go down to, well, it's just my opinion, like, you know, like my favorite flavor of ice cream, that just, nobody cares. Nobody cares about your favorite flavor. We all care about, you know, should you feed ice cream to a starving person or should you share your ice cream with somebody? That's a good question, but nobody cares about the flavor. And the kids know this. But the problem is that because we've worshipped the individual for so long and we've worshipped relativism for so long that we've lost the vocabulary to talk about it or the courage. So, you know, just to give the kids the courage to stand behind their convictions, even if they're wrong, give them the courage and say, stand up. Let's see what you can do. So I think that's part of what we're trying to do in education, too, is a good Catholic education or just a good humanist education is, you know, take it, you know, say what you think and let's have it out and let's not get mad when people disagree with us. Let's love each other to the truth.
And as I hear you share this and, you know, I think about Gravissimum Educationes and all of the church's documents on education, the excitement about the work of education gets, you know, it resurges. But it is very clear that at the institutional level, there are numerous Catholic schools out there that willingly believe that embracing a STEM-based empiricist materialist education is the way to go and that the faith is this ancillary thing that's done in the school.
Yeah. And that's why that's what we're trying to do with our, you know, Master's Degree program here in Ave Maria is reintroduce folks to the deeper philosophical exploration that's happening in the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially getting back to philosophical realism and then identifying these problems so that you don't just take over a school or start working in a school and just saying, oh, this is what we taught, this is what we've always taught, it's time to teach AP history now. You can teach AP history. I don't recommend it, but you could do it, you know, in a faithful Catholic institution if it's done carefully and correctly. But just to simply educate the kids because we're handing on what the culture says we should hand on, well, which culture? Is it the humanist, atheistic, secular culture that's been in charge, or is it going to be the Catholic culture, the culture of Christ and his saints?
Dan, tremendously insightful. Thank you very much for making the time today.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Dan Guernsey, Senior Fellow at the Cardinal Newman Institute, Director of Ave Maria University's Master of Education's and Catholic Educational Leadership Program. And we've been talking about this ethos and framework for Catholic education, being that it is Catholic Schools Week. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.